A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the Football Writers Podcast. My name is Mike Calvin. I'm joined by John Cross of the Daily Mirror and Tony Evans of the Evening Standard. It's incredible to think that Liverpool could finish an incredible season with nothing. Tottenham are running on empty at the worst time of year. Now, this might not go down well with everyone, but the rest of Europe probably wants a Cruyff final. Ajax, Barcelona, the Champions League, a celebration of the game's finer virtues. Understand that, John?
I understand the romance of it, but from a very English point of view, I do think that we dreamed perhaps of having an all-English Champions League final. There's a decent chance we might get that in the Europa League final, but I just think it's been a cruel week, isn't it, for the two English teams in the Champions League, simply because I don't think anyone, even though it finished 3-0 to Barcelona, no one could have really complained if Liverpool had got a draw in the Nou Camp. It wouldn't have been that rough a justice. Liverpool played ever so well, but just maybe Klopp got it slightly wrong. They would sort of look back on chances to score that you know, could have given them a precious away goal, and then the tie wouldn't be over. I'm not sure it's completely dead, but you'd have to say it's a massive long shot, and you really wouldn't fancy Barcelona not to score if Liverpool are chasing the game. And conversely, also Spurs. I just fancy Spurs. I still don't think that they're dead in the water yet, because I think they've got goals in them, particularly Son coming back, who's got this great habit of being almost the ultimate player for a counter-attacking team, because he's got, you know, he's got great pace, he's got fantastic movement, and he can really relish on Spurs if they're sitting deep trying to defend. Then Spurs have been very good in Europe this season, away from home, getting results away from home and hitting teams on the counter. So I do still think that Spurs just might ruin that vision of a Cruyff final yet.
Let's start with Liverpool, Tony. Obviously, a club you know well. Let's accentuate the negative. If they miss out on both, what impact will that have?
I don't think there's too much of an impact this year, because there's a great sense, there's still a great sense of progression about Klopp. I mean, it's remarkable to think, you know, he's in his fourth year now, and by, you know, so it's early on next season and starts his fifth. There's a freshness and there's a sense of them moving forward. At some point, they're going to have to win trophies. But I think this season, even if they come second, you know, this, you know, third highest points total ever, that gets them off the hook, you know, sort of, and they should be on the hook. You know, getting to the semi-final of the Champions League, getting beat by Barcelona if they do, well, that, you know, no one could be embarrassed by that, and, you know, Lionel Messi. So there is, I think there'll be a great sense of positivity in the summer. I think his danger year is next year if they don't live up to expectations and they don't sort of put the pressure on City again. If the other teams in the, you know, the other four teams in the top six raise the games and challenge them, I think that'll be the danger time where people start to question. But at the moment, I think regardless of what happens in the next 10 days, people will come out of this season and go, Liverpool fans will go, yeah, you know what? That was a positive season. That's brilliant. Klopp's the man, and Klopp's the man to bring the title back. So I think that's the mood there.
You know, Anfield will be buzzing, as it is in these occasions. Liverpool obviously need to sort of ride that emotional wave. Do they need to actually just basically throw themselves, you know, come hell or high water, at Barcelona?
Probably, but with a bit of balance, because I just think in Lionel Messi, you have got a player who can win games, turn games on his own. And I think if you do leave him isolated, if you do leave him on his own, he's so dangerous. I thought that the way that the tie was structured, i.e. Liverpool going away first, would give them a real edge, simply because I think we've seen it so many times before that Barcelona away from home in the first leg, and then they're left with a, you know, a bit of work to do still at the Nou Camp. And then that is when Messi is at his most dangerous, because when he dominates and takes over a game, as he did in the first leg, then he can absolutely kill you. But I think the worry for Liverpool is that we've seen, particularly our draw in last season, where they went into games last season against Man City and against Roma, for example. They blew them away, didn't they, in the first half an hour. And I can see that they'll really go for it early on. And if they could sort of get a goal in the first 10 or 15 minutes, that would give them a hell of a start. But from there, you almost have to be a little bit more patient. Because if they could make it 2-0 before half-time, suddenly everyone would be completely buzzing. But it's what you leave at the other end. Because I don't think this is a vintage Barcelona team. I really don't. Arthur is a good player in midfield, but, you know, Busquets is maybe coming towards the end a little bit. You know, he's not the force that he was.
Vidal's never really convinced.
Absolutely. And you know, defensively, still, I think there's a few question marks, even though, you know, people rightly say that Piqué is arguably having his best season ever for Barcelona. He really does look good at times. But I just think that there are opportunities and there will be cracks, but it will depend on getting that balance between kind of early momentum against a little bit of patience.
So in a sense, it's another test of the maturity of both Klopp and his team, isn't it, Tony?
Yeah, and I thought they showed immaturity at the end of the game in the Nou Camp by throwing so many people forward. You're 3-0 down, don't overcommit and let them get a fourth, because then it really is over. And, you know, if Dembele doesn't, let's say, lose his bottle at the end, it's 4-0, and that's just daft. At 3-0, you got to take a big, deep breath and say, OK, right, you know, we have blown teams away at Anfield. You know, there's not just last year in the Champions League, you know, the year before Dortmund. You know, it is possible. I mean, less likely because it's Barcelona. But, you know, you've got to be calm about it. So, yeah, I think they'll start off. I think where you can get Barcelona is run at them. You know, there are running lanes through that midfield, which we saw at the Nou Camp. And the defence, I think, are the most uncomfortable when they're, you know, sort of either turned round or backpedalling. So I think they've got to do that. There is a chance. I wouldn't think there's too much of a chance.
Yeah, because the one thing that did impress me about Barcelona, you know, above and beyond, obviously, Messi, was the fact, almost like their game intelligence, that they, you know, they looked at the Liverpool press and thought, right, and they knew the time to counteract that. You know, and I suppose if you look at that, you know, in human form, it's embodied in someone like Busquets, for instance, you know. So Barcelona, you know, they're not just a one-man team, are they? There is a culture there that they represent as well.
Yeah, there is. And I think the game management is particularly pertinent when it comes to, you know, the game at Anfield. If you do suddenly find yourselves ahead, then not to commit too much more in search of the definitive goal or the equalising goal. Because otherwise, you know, if Barcelona score, then you need five. And then that really is, a disaster. So that's about game management. And I do talk about sort of Busquets, you know, maybe reaching the end. But actually, the reality is that when you have sort of wily old stages like that, they are the masters at sort of kind of just knowing when to kind of sit and defend, be disciplined, sit back. And Liverpool, let's be honest, had a great deal of pressure at various points. I mean, the second half of the first half, I thought they were terrific. And then, the first 20, 25 minutes of the second half, again, absolutely bossing the game, really. But then it was Barcelona reading the signals, wasn't it? And then breaking and then counter-attacking. It was a fascinating game of chess. Absolutely, they break it up, don't they?
Yeah, they know how to disrupt play. And Liverpool are very naive that way. They don't.
It's an interesting because you actually can see parallels in Barcelona and Manchester City in that tactical fouling that you see.
But Pep says it never happens.
Yeah, right. Okay. Talking of Pep, you know, there's been a lot of talk, obviously, because of the whole Cruyff celebration that people are talking about his relationship with Cruyff himself. What are the intrinsic differences between the two of them? Is it a case of Cruyff being the romantic and Guardiola being a bit more of the realist?
Yeah, I think Guardiola strikes a nice balance between the two because, yeah, he is sort of realistic, I think, in his approach. And he's a bit more, how can I put this, a bit more modern in his approach in terms of, you know, in terms of those sort of kind of tactical fouls, which obviously never happened. But he's a shrewd operator, isn't he? Because sometimes he will change the system. You know, the way that he's sort of kind of, I think he did it a little bit more last season when he opted for a three rather than a four, for example. But he's a little bit more versatile in midfield and in what he does. But I do think that Guardiola is absolutely, I think he's incredibly cute when reading situations. Though what I would say is that there's a few question marks still over the Champions League, isn't there, for Guardiola? And you'd have to say that I think that would be his biggest frustration of indeed the season, really. And I think that Cruyff always seemed to be able to, when he was a manager, just be able to play the beautiful game, but also get results. And he sort of embraced and embodied the two. And you could understand why Guardiola was so inspired, obviously, by him. But I just think that would be the greatest frustration, I think, out of those two. But it's such fine margins, isn't it? Because, you know, Man City have faltered. Liverpool now look as if they might sort of falter in this competition. But the margins are so slight. Mm. And I think that's what almost makes the Champions League such a high risk and such a high entertainment business, because it is so, it's done on the smallest of margins, and that sets out the greats, isn't it? I mean, Cruyff, as we sort of talk about there, has had so much success on it. And when you consider that those margins involved between success and failure, there's nothing in it, and that sets apart the greats, I think.
Mm. Given that, Tony, where does Klopp rate in the whole sort of pantheon of modern managers? Just below the top level?
I mean, it depends who you put on the top level. I think he's in the top rank. You know, he probably needs to win a title at Liverpool and, you know, the Champions League to actually cement himself upright at the top. But, you know, you've got to say, I put it in simplest terms, he's the best manager Liverpool could get. And I think almost every team except City in the Premier League would probably swap for him if they had a chance. And most of Europe, I mean, the outside, probably Barcelona and Real Madrid, and frankly, Real Madrid might. So yeah, he's up there, and I think deservedly so. Ideally, you know, he will bring a trophy to Anfield, and that's, you know, the club's ready for it. But yeah, I'd put him up there. I mean, I think he's Guardiola's got a slightly different sort of status because what he did at Barcelona. But yeah, he's. I think they're the two best managers in Europe.
Yeah. Did he make a strategic mistake in the first leg by including Joe Gomez? And, you know, that signalled a little bit of caution to me.
Yeah, I think it was clear that Trent was going to have a difficult night. You know, they're going to push Alba up on him, Coutinho and probably double up. And people have tried that in Europe before. And he's, you know, there's times when he's struggled and there's times when he's coped, but he's a year older. I thought that was a mistake because, you know, the fullbacks, the width they give Liverpool and the space they create going forward, never mind the crossing, because we all know about the crossing, but they spread the opposition defence in midfield and allow more running lanes there. So I think personally that was a mistake. I mean, he's not going to get any help from Salah in front if he plays Trent. That's clear. And we've seen that before in Europe. But, you know, say to one of the other midfielders, drop in. And I'm, you know, I'm not so sure playing Wijnaldum in that sort of, I mean, people were saying a false nine. It's kind of, everything was false about it. Never mind the nine. It didn't work. You know, he probably would have been better. There's a case sometimes for going to a flat four in midfield and playing two up front.
At a game like that, in a big game like that, just changing everything.
Well, if you haven't got the personnel to play your favoured system, then it's stupid playing the favoured system. If you ask me, I think you've got to be more pragmatic. You've got to say what suits these players, and clearly that position didn't suit Wijnaldum.
Mm. You mentioned Son earlier on, and we'll talk about Tottenham in a minute, John. Firmino, He was missed, wasn't he?
Massively. And I do think we're caught in between the sort of discussion over whether he was fully fit or whether basically it was a sort of a tactical one. But it was such a big, it's such a big one, wasn't it? And immediately his absence from the previous weekend made you think, oh, you know, it's... I just think Liverpool are in a position now where they... Yeah, it sounds really naive, but I think if they're at full strength, why not, you know, take the game to Barcelona? And that, I think that's what arguably they would have done, maybe with a little bit more, you know, cautious or caution in midfield, just to sort of balance it up. But I think we'll always be wondering, what if, you know, what if they'd done something different at right back? What if they basically Firmino had been fully fit? Because there's no way, I don't think, Firmino is fully fit then he doesn't play. Mm. But then all of a sudden, you know, you've got this weird sort of system and that feeling of frustration, really, because as well as Liverpool played, I just think if they had their best 11 out, their best system out, then I think they would have got far more from the game. And it is a big frustration simply because I think that everyone stood back and admired, you know, the two best teams by an absolute country mile in English football this season. And I think it will be frustrating that we would argue that they're the best two teams in Europe as well. Mm. And I don't think that's being a little Englander. I think that's a genuine case. And unfortunately, we've, for one reason or another, we, you know, it looks like neither will make the final.
Mm. You've seen a lot of great European Liverpool teams in Europe, Tony. Mm. Where does this group compare to the rest?
Frankly, until they win it, they don't, do they? I mean, it's and, you know, they're exciting and they're great, and it's. It, you know, it's fantastic. It's wonderful to watch, but we don't want to get into the Wenger syndrome, do we? Where, you know, like the football, you know, the exciting football, it's a joy to watch and you win nothing for a long time. You know, that's not the Liverpool way. The Liverpool way, I mean, you know, one of the best Liverpool teams I've ever seen go away in Europe was the 84 team that went to Rome. And you know what? It was a battle. It was a fight. There was not an ounce of entertainment in the game. You know, and it was just a... You know, tooth and nail, you know, and they had to hang on against a team playing at home, a very good team with Brazilians, you know, in a, you know, Italian World Cup winners. And, you know, you might look at them and you go, oh, well, this team, I destroyed them, they'd run at them. But again, those teams are gamecraft. They knew how to win games. They knew how to win games that they shouldn't win. This team has a tendency, of, you know, and they've only been beaten once this year by City in the league, and the margins were so narrow, it was untrue. Could have gone either way. But they're still, when they get to this level, and again, in Kiev last year against Real Madrid, there's teams you look at and on paper you go, you know what, Liverpool have got a chance here. And the likes of Real Madrid and Barcelona put them in the place. So if they want to be compared to the great Liverpool teams, they've got to put some trophies in the cabinet. And until then, I think we should avoid that question.
Yeah, OK. Keita, he's basically done for a couple of months because of an adductor injury. Is that the area, you know, with your reservations, Tony, that Liverpool need to improve on, that midfield area?
Yeah, it is a weird dilemma, really, because... You know, I was talking to one of the sort of the Merseyside boys about it the other day, and sort of saying what's the best midfield trio, and he said a trio which was different from one of the other guys on the beat, and yeah. I had said to me a few days previously, and it's almost finding that, and I do think it's pretty helpful, you know, to be kind of fluid and have a sort of a different, slightly different system. And that, and I think there's no doubt about it. You can't knock Klopp for this season because they've, you know, I would argue, still done so well over the course of the season. And the midfield is the one area where it's been completely rotated through the course of it. But I do think also, though, it's pretty helpful sometimes to have that almost that first choice. And what would that be? That would be Wijnaldum. You know, you could make the case for Henderson Milner. Mm. Or Fabinho, you know, has had a great run. And then Keita. And the only thing I would say about Keita is I think he's had good spells in the season. I also think he's had sort of bad spells. Mm. There's no getting away from that. Because I think what he was bought to do and has offered on occasions, maybe there's a potential there. I mean, you know, I think a lot of the best players in the Premier League who have come from overseas have maybe taken a year to bed in. and I'm talking about the very, very best. So maybe it's just a case of bedding in. Because when we've seen the flashes of there, he's a dynamic player who feeds strikers brilliantly, who breaks forward well, is good on the ball. I just think there's all the ingredients there. But I do think that that would be the one area where Klopp could possibly arguably say, I could find someone better or find someone else to complement it. Because, you know, that everyone individually has done really well. I mean, I was amazed that Wijnaldum didn't make the PFA Team of the Year because I think he's been brilliant at times, a bit of an unsung hero. Mm. But as for the rest, I think there's one maybe vacancy. I don't know what you think.
I mean, it's Keita has struggled with the physicality over here, and you know, and that it's taken a long time for him to actually feel confident in you know, sort of in that, and Klopp hasn't trusted him to play because he's a terrible one for not looking over his shoulder, and he doesn't press as well. Fabinho, the worries with him is that whether he was mobile enough, particularly side to side, lesser worry up and down, but you know, across the width of the pitch, which you need to do in a Klopp team. So I mean, they were the two players that last summer everyone thought would come in and change. I mean, you know, so I think most people thought the Champions League three in the midfield, you know, Wijnaldum, Milner and Henderson were probably, I mean, it's too strong to say the worst midfield in a Champions League final from the Champions League era. But, you know, it's like you look at them and you say they're a bit one-dimensional and they were tired. They played a lot last year. So, you know, you got to look at that. The plus side is that both Fabinho and Keita have actually, you know, grown in the last couple of months, and have been able to. It means that the others have been able to rest a little bit, but it's still a bit uncertain. You know what the front three are going to be. You know what the back four is going to be. The midfield, you know, toss a coin, pick a card, you know, pay him three from five or six.
And at least they've got squad depth, whereas Spurs, probably being found out because of their lack of depth, they really need Son's come back firing, and also, do they really need to take an absolute eyeballs out gamble and say to Kane, give us a game?
I think it would be a massive gamble because he has started doing some more, shall we say, you know, training work. But I do still think that ordinarily he would still be, say, 2 weeks away. And then I think it's a big, big gamble. I know where you're coming from because he's such a difference for
talismanic figure, isn't he?
He is, and it's hard to explain this, but I was sort of talking, you know, we were in the press conference the other day and I sort of kind of asked Pochettino about basically, and I tried to sort of say, you know, is it a positive that basically other players have stepped up in Kane's absence? And they have. They've actually stepped up and shared the goals amongst them. I guess the difference on Tuesday night was that Son wasn't there and was suspended. But I think that, you know, sometimes Pochettino can't see that, but anything as a negative. And it's certainly not intended, because I think Spurs have missed Kane, obviously, for big chunks of this season because of injury. And other players have stepped up and almost relished and sharing that extra responsibility. But I just think it's probably too quick, too soon. If you asked Harry Kane, he'd be desperate to play and be there. But it's about the strength and condition of his ankles, you know. And they have, look, it's become an issue for Harry Kane, isn't it? You know, other players are sort of kind of tainted by being called injury prone. You know, it's a worry. And Kane's sort of in that territory. He really needs kind of to come back. So I think the worst thing that could happen for Harry Kane, who I think, you know, is an absolute national treasure, and I want him to be fit for the Nations League, by the way, is basically to come back too soon, get injured again, and everyone's saying, oh, he's a bit of a crock, isn't he? I mean, think that would be unfair.
This could, you know, shorten his career. I mean, it's a recurring injury anyway. The best thing that could happen to him, I think, is, you know, he'd love to play in the semi. He'd love to reach the final and play in it. He'd love to play in the, you know, in the Nations League. But the reality is, the best thing for him would be a summer off, get it straight, and come back next year. And hopefully, it, you know, there's no structural weakness there.
Mm. You're at the Spurs first leg.
Mm.
Vertonghen. You know, we're talking about player welfare here, you know, and we were talking, you know, similarly about Kane. FIFA are talking about, you know, maybe introducing concussion substitutions, you know, in the way that they would do in, say, rugby. Is that overdue?
it is overdue. And I also wonder, because it's something obviously that happens in the NFL as well a little bit, doesn't it? And I wonder whether in the practical, intense and sort of dynamic of football, whether it really works. I just think the biggest single thing that I think is glaring from English football, and indeed European football, and FIFA and UEFA have to look at it globally, I think, is independent doctors. I mean, it's all well and good to say, you know, these are highly trained, highly professional individuals, as the club medics always are. But it's just, you imagine having, as a club medic, having a relationship with a player, having a relationship with a manager. They're looking at you, and you've got to make this decision completely cold. And yes, I know that they're brilliant in their field, but that is an unfair pressure, whether or not they make the right decision. But I looked and I was gobsmacked that Vertonghen, you know, came back on. And of course the player is brave, he's brilliant, he's a fantastic player. Of course he wants to play on, but should he have been allowed to? Well, I think the evidence tells us otherwise. And listen, I know that they've had the concussion tests and that, you know, the concussion tests have come back negative. But it really is unbelievably frustrating that basically a game of that magnitude, that there's not an independent doctor to make a ruling on that. Whether or not that was indeed concussion, that's almost irrelevant. We should have an independent doctor there on the sidelines. I know that FIFA Pro, you know, the European-wide football players union, basically are pushing hard to have independent doctors in time for the Women's World Cup, which I think would be a huge step forward. I just think that this week's events, and it was totally shocking to see Vertonghen go off like he did. It really, if you can't be moved by that, then I'm sorry. You know, you've got no feeling for it at all. The sooner we get independent doctors, that's the key more than anything else, anything at all.
I think there's a broader issue here as well, isn't there? Where, you know, you look, we've got a generation of players who are dying through dementia. There are established links through, you know, people like Jeff Hastell from CTE, brain damage, industrial disease, to quote the coroner in his case, from heading a football. You've got people like Dawn Astell, you know, his daughter, waging almost like a sole campaign against it. Football needs to step up and basically, you know, recognise its duty of care, doesn't it?
Oh, definitely, definitely. I mean, it's, you know, the concussion and head injuries actually might ultimately kill the NFL. And it'll never get that bad in football for obvious reasons, a different game and that they itch you take. But I think it's really important to protect the players and protect them from themselves. You know, this is where the PFA should have done more. And Dawn Astell's been particularly vocal about that. And she's right. You know, it's an area where the unions let the players down. And I think the authorities have let the players down. Everyone needs to take a long, hard look at it. And, you know, it's, you looked at the blow of Vertonghen, so he looked at how long he was down and when he got up, you know, it's, he shouldn't have been anywhere near that pitch again. He should have been straight out, gone to get a scan, being looked at and make sure that, you know, he was okay, because, you know, we've seen, and thankfully it's pretty rare, but we've seen blows to the head and we've seen, you know, people die from it, you know, a couple of hours later. You just can't be doing that.
I spoke to a FIFA Pro member this week, board member, who was basically saying if you do suffer that concussion and then suffer another concussion, which admittedly, you know, he even sort of said, you know, it would be obviously quite rare, within, say, half an hour, you are putting a player's life at risk. Just imagine that. I mean, it's just incredible to think. And they are also dealing with insurance cases now where a player has suffered. And get this, you know, if you're a defender or a striker, 5 or 6 concussions during, you know, so that's classed as a concussion, which isn't that rare, let me tell you, you know, for a player, during the course of a career, that they can have massive long-term effects on a brain, you know, that basically could leave you, you know, with serious migraines, with serious damage. You know, he's telling a story about one player who cannot even now, you know, be out in sunlight because of the devastating effects on the brain because of 5 or 6 concussions during his career. We really have, I think, in football, not taking this, you know, seriously enough at all. Mm. And now finally, you know, I think it's seriously sad that something so shocking and indeed, you know, it's not even classed as a concussion that has finally woken people up on it.
All I can say, and I get the plug in now, you know, we've done an interview with Dawn Astle for a documentary, State of Play, which is going out in BT Sport initially after the Europa League final. And anyone who sees that interview will understand the magnitude of the problem and relate to it on a human level. Mm-hmm. So moving on from that, the players themselves are, as we all know, really valuable commodities, aren't they? Mm. In that sense, why should Maurizio Pochettino be continually having to rattle the begging bowl?
Well, it's, you know, Tottenham famously struggled a little bit to... I mean, they've actually done quite well, wheeling and dealing over the years in the transfer market. But building this new stadium, a lot of money have gone to that, the delays. They didn't have a lot of cash last summer, the summer before. You know, it's, well, you can see the way they've done things, the business side of it has not really meant that there was going to be a lot of money spent on players. And that was always going to happen. So I think it was still a dereliction of duty by a number of people at the club last summer not to get more people in and sort of pad the squad because they look knackered. You know, you could see the looming storm last week against West Ham. You know, they were shattered, you know, as a group. And, you know, Dele Alli, you look at him and you think, the kid needs a break. Mm. You know, he's he looked really leg weary, and you know that the base that he has, you know, you're seeing it less and less, and he just needs more. You know, you look at the bench as well. You know, there's a shortage of strikers, a shortage of midfielders, and a shortage of defenders. I mean, you know,
got three goalies though.
Well, yeah, you know, played them in the back three. The whole thing, it's remarkable that Pochettino's done so well with them. Mm. You know, sort of given the situation. Mm. And I mean, they say that, you know, Tottenham will benefit from the new stadium long term. And in 10 years, you know, everyone might say, oh, yeah, it was the best thing. In the short term, then it's left Pochettino, as you say, with a begging bowl. And basically, everyone's walking past, not looking them in the eye.
Yeah, yeah. Because as he says himself, Tottenham is a club at a crossroads. Now they're talking about maybe giving him three more players. You know, talk of Andre Gomez, you know, nicking him from Everton. Is that going to be enough?
I think that Pochettino really... There's two sides to the argument, really. I think there's obviously, you know, there was questioning of why the club didn't do any deals last summer. But there's also a school of thought with Pochettino is that he's so loyal to his players that actually he can be reluctant to move them on. Mm. And sometimes he just has this unshakable, unmovable loyalty to them that makes him think, well, do I want to leave him out of the squad? Can I move him on? What about him? I've promised him this. And, you know, if to sign another player, I'll have to get rid of him. I think that what this season has taught him, as well as they've done, I think there's also mixed in there a little bit of frustration that they couldn't have pushed on league-wise. For him to have done so well, I think, to make them competitive and also still to reach a Champions League semi-final and still have a chance of reaching the final is remarkable. But I think it will have taught him that actually he needs to freshen up, because I do think sometimes it's not just about sort of superstar signings, it's keeping it fresh to kind of keep that competition there, but also kind of, I think sometimes the dynamic just needs shaking up. So whether that means kind of moving Trippier on, for example, and getting a new right back, chipping one midfielder out. Maybe they might lose Eriksen, for example, because he's only got 1 year left this summer. So that's a very real issue. I think they'll have to make a judgment call on that, because if he's not going to sign, I think they'll have to sell him this summer. It would be financial, you know, suicide not to, really. And I just think that they'll have to make some calls. But the one thing is that I'm certain about is that I think he'll want to make some changes. Because if this season has taught him anything, it's kind of don't rest on your laurels. And I think that there's no doubt about it. I think they're in pole position for Ryan Sessegnon. You know, Jack Grealish, we've sort of kind of spoken about, sort of kind of as you know, I'm sure he'd be a good signing. But I think that will depend on whether Villa go up or not. And I just think there will be some changes. And I think actually that'll be a really exciting start for Spurs. But I think they'll probably have to use the money that they may or may not get from Ericsson, if indeed he does go, to do that.
The other side of it, though, as well, if they do bring someone in and they pay big money for them, it'll just explode their pay structure. Because, the one thing Tottenham don't do is pay top-whack wages. And that's where they're also vulnerable this summer and going forward. Unless they pay the going rate, players like, at some point, players like Kane and Ali are going to go, you know what? I could double me money elsewhere. And that tends to happen when you bring a big money buy-in and they're on constant wages and the rest of the dressing room go, hang on.
Well, look at what's happening at Man United, for instance.
Yeah.
With Sanchez.
Yeah.
Well, I'll have some of that, please.
Yeah.
Understandable. If, John, as Tony says, Spurs are leg-weary, Ajax are probably the last team they want to play, aren't they?
Yeah, probably. I just thought Ajax were brilliant the other night. Absolutely fantastic, weren't they? I mean, everyone's been raving about De Jong, and understandably all season. Delight, was fantastic, I thought, although not particularly tested,
Can he do better than Bayern, by the way? He's been linked very heavily.
Arguably, he looks so elegant, doesn't he? I mean, he reads the game brilliantly. He's a step ahead of all, the strikers, and basically brings the ball out. He can step out. He can, his distribution is fantastic. And he looks a really, really quality player. It was, I don't know, it sort of struck me as kind of a mix between sort of Ronald Koeman and just honestly the best sort of combination of kind of the best midfield, the midfielder that you can think of, almost like sweeper territory, really. And I thought, arguably, and Van der Beek, super player, wasn't he? And
he looks a Premier League player.
He really does. He's made for it, isn't he? He's got all the attributes, And to be honest, I think that their regret will be that they could have finished it off, because in that first 25-minute spell, that was as devastating, as you could have imagined. And they basically should have certainly scored a second goal. He had a chance, didn't he, to score a second goal, denied by Lloris, but that was a good chance. And then basically obviously hit the post late on. But I was impressed with the way Spurs battled back, particularly after, obviously, Sissoko came on. But Ajax look a really, really good team. But I do think if you trace their results through the competition, they've been more impressive away from home. So I do still, that's why I think as good as Ajax have been, and they've been great, I think sometimes the keeper looks a bit excitable, could be gettable. But I also think that at home, I still think that Spurs are not quite out of this yet.
OK. Let's look at the Europa League semi-finals. Chelsea, unbeaten in the last 16 Europa League games, a record. Decent enough result in Germany. Will they have enough to get over the line?
You'd think so. It's one of those situations where they've got players who should be, as a team, they should be performing better than they're doing. And we can talk forever about the dysfunction at Stamford Bridge, and it doesn't change. Maybe it'll have to change. If this transfer ban is upheld, and they've got to bring people back from on loan. Maybe they'll have to, use some of the players who've come out of that youth system in the academy. But at the moment, it's in many ways the same old story. You just feel they're slightly underachieving. It's chewing up and spitting out a manager who come with a great record and a great reputation. They're probably back into the top four simply because. Because Arsenal and United are so poor, is what's going on there good? Would that be a victory? I don't think so. I think it's one of those clubs that someone needs to press the reset button, and they need to start again with a different philosophy. What will it do if they get in the top four? They get to the final of this, it'll paper over a multitude of cracks, and we'll see the same situation going forward. But yet you'd think, with Hazard in that team, there's probably in his final few games for Chelsea, they should get to the final and, probably win it.
Because they strike me, John, as a team without a real identity.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I do think 1-1 away to Eintracht Frankfurt is a decent result. And the Sarri ball has just basically divided the Chelsea fans, isn't it? And well, I say divided.
Well, 99% against
them. Yeah, I'd say 90-10. But, you know, it was incredibly attractive what he did at Napoli. And he's tried to instigate this. But it's just too rigid. And I don't know whether that's the players or the system or a bit of both, that the players don't fit the system. But he has just... I mean, the way that he's sort of stuck and refused to change and you know, the substitutes highlight that, don't they? You know, it's a set minute and set sort of group of players that sort of rotating every game. It's crazy. I mean, the Hazard thing last night, you know, on the bench. I mean, you know, it's bonkers. But then you also see weird things like, you know, I mean, Matt Hughes, I noticed from the Times, has written a story that I thought was really interesting, because he's great on Chelsea, Matt, and he's written this story saying that it's basically that selection has worried sort of the Chelsea hierarchy. Well, good story, not knocking that, but how dare they? I mean, that's up to the manager. You can't have the board picking the players. Oh, well, you know, it's crazy.
A former manager, when the team was announced, get texts from the boardroom which would say, the owner doesn't like this team. You know, it's... But that's Chelsea. I mean, you know, since Mourinho was sacked first time in 2007, they've done everything they could to minimise the power of the manager. And we're seeing the illogical conclusion of that now. You know, it's, you know, Mourinho and Conte won titles and were gone, you know, the next year. You know, Sarri is... And I haven't got a great deal of sympathy for Sarri in the sense that I don't like template managers. You know, you look at your squad and you go, oh, how can I get the best out of these players? No, this is what we're going to do. Now, I know it's not I know you won't like this position, but you playing that, it never works long term. Yeah. So I don't have a lot of sympathy.
I'm amazed that someone behind Kante hasn't said, hang on a second.
Yeah.
You know, he would fit into any team in the world, Kante. Yeah. And I think he's been wasted.
Completely and utterly. And you know, and to basically allow Jorginho to play in that, and why? Who thinks this is a good idea?
Right, Arsenal, well-run club.
Oh, it's really weird with Arsenal, because I do think that if you'd have said at the start of the season, if you'd have asked any Arsenal fan, and then basically said you'll be in a European semi-final, within touching distance of the final after the first leg. They would have bitten your hand off and said Unai Emery is an absolute genius. But the problem is with this is that basically, once you raise expectations, which I think Emery did on that long unbeaten run, and then also got to a point before the Crystal Palace game that they think, yeah, this is our top four place for the taking, then I'm sorry, but they come crashing back down to earth when it doesn't go right. The problem with Emery is that I think the results tell us that, you know, he's doing quite well. And it's a tough job following on from a managerial legend in Arsene Wenger. And so, you know, to do that has done quite well. But what, you know, I still think, what is the identity of that team? Almost as much as Sarri, you know. Is it a pressing team? Is it a possession team?
It's a bad defensive team.
Well, it really is. And honestly, he needs massive reinforcements this summer. He's certainly not got the cash as it stands to do that. He really hasn't. And, you know, they need to get rid of certain players to bring others in. I think they've only got about 40, 45 million pounds tops. And they are looking at a box-to-box midfielder to replace Ramsey. And they're looking for a wide attacker, you know. And so where's the defence come in? So they've got to ship some out before. That squad needs a lot of work. And so arguably, you could say if it needs a lot of work, then he's done very, very well to get them this far. But I do think there's a few things that just doesn't feel right at the moment.
That'd be a compelling argument if, basically, 12 teams in the division went abject rubbish.
Yeah.
You know, who don't even challenge the top six most of the time, the Manchester challenge Arsenal. I mean, it's the opposite in many ways. There's no template at Arsenal, as you say, there's no identity. He's tried to mix and match and shift things around, but it all just feels a little late era Wenger without the entertainment.
Yeah.
It's, you know, and
the football isn't great, honestly. I know people who, you know, sort of say that. Then there have been really good games this season, but sometimes the football, we think. And that was the thing with Wenger. He did at least try and play football. Everyone knows he needed to change, but Arsenal just looking for that identity.
Speaking of Wenger, by the way, where do you think he'll end up? Lyon are obviously sniffing.
Yeah, well, they won't give up. But I personally think, you know, I've written about this, that basically I think he's enjoying his life so much. And far, far greater, by the way, than I actually think he thought he would. Because, I was in touch with him fairly recently, and there's no doubt about it. I think he's enjoying himself far more than he thought. He's proved to be a brilliant TV pundit. I think he's probably had opportunities. But I think this time out of the game has made him realise, you know what, I've missed an awful lot of my life. I've sacrificed everything 24/7 for 22 years. If I was a betting man, I would say he won't return to club management. Mm. And then he'll take up some sort of advisory role, technical director role, either at a top club or perhaps more likely a governing body. Yeah. FIFA have been keen on him.
Yeah, and that's most likely. I mean, he's... apparently he's found out that going out for lunch is a good thing.
Yeah, you know, he's great. Yeah, absolutely.
We'll make a journey out of it. Yeah. Right, just a couple of very quick questions. One from Jonathan Brick. What can Liverpool 2019 learn from Arsenal 2004?
I don't think much at all, really. I mean, from the Invincibles? Well, I suppose what you could learn is that freshen up the team by the right players, because actually the Invincibles, I don't know whether you'll agree with me on this, John, you know, you saw far more than me in that era, but although they went unbeaten that season, the signs of decline were there. The teams over the previous 2 years were better. The Arsenal teams, they moved the ball quicker. The movement off the ball was better, and it's held up as one of the great years. But if I was going to pick my favourite Arsenal team of that period, I'd probably pick one of the two previous seasons where they seem to be firing on all cylinders properly. So I suppose what you could learn from that is that there's likely to be other teams coming up on your shoulder any second. People are going to get their act together. Other teams in the top. In the top six. And Arsenal didn't realise in 2004 that Chelsea were about to, sit on the front lawn and fire the £50 notes, famously. So I suppose you learn, don't stand still. Whenever you stand still, you're going backwards because other people are moving forwards.
Right. Two more questions, which I'll fuse into one, actually, because they're very similar. Umair Ali asks, if we only have one English team in the final, is that a sign of success or a sign that English teams only look great in the Premier League? Michael Wills adds to that, would no English team in the Champions League final indicate that the Premier League still needs to catch up?
Yes, I do think that... Well, I would say in answer to the first one, I think it's obvious that I think the best two teams by some distance in the Premier League are Liverpool and Man City. In a cup competition, you're always going to rely on an element of luck. It could have been just so obvious that they basically could have been drawn together. So I think you always have that element. On the second one, I do think that, bearing in mind, we had such a strong representation in the latter stages of it. Of course, it will be disappointing if they don't cross the line. And I think where it should be the wake-up call is that basically, is the Premier League too intense? Does it do enough to help and support the teams in the European competition? I think we need to look at maybe shifting fixtures a bit more on a formal level, because at the moment it is informal. Look at what the Dutch did. And there's no doubt about it. Ajax played fresher. They were bright, they were enthusiastic, and they had an extra yard on Spurs. Why? Because they'd had the previous 10 days off.
OK, very, very quickly, who's in your finals?
I think the Europa will be an all-English final. And then I think it will be a Spurs-Barcelona final.
Ajax-Barcelona. And, you know, it's a... But I've got to say at this point, I kind of don't get the big Cruyff love in. You know, it's Barcelona, one of the worst clubs in the world, if not the worst, most hypocritical club in the world, more than a club, yeah, one of the most rapacious businesses ever. And Ajax, you know, they probably should be more successful. Look at the catchment area. You know, they get the best players, you know, obviously with PSV. Yeah, the best players, you know, sort of from the area, they should have moments like this more often. You know, the whole of the Netherlands and probably most of Belgium they can pick from and parts of Germany. So, you know what? They're welcome to it.
And the Europa League?
The Europa League. Oh, it'll be a London derby in Baku, I should think. Can you imagine that?
I love it when Tony sits on the fence. I can't see beyond Ajax Barca, but there might be an unpleasant upset in the Europa League. Valencia-Chelsea final, anyone? Thanks for joining us here on the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud. Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.